The Drinking Hour on Food FM.
You're listening to The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in association with the International Wine and Spirit Competition, using the best in the world to judge the best in the world.
Hello and welcome to The Drinking Hour from Food FM with me, David Kermode. Episode 86, and this week we're joined by renowned Bordeaux expert Stephen Brook, whose superlative work, The Complete Bordeaux, the fourth edition, has just been released. Plus, later on, some medal-winning wines from the IWSC Hall of Fame.
The Drinking Hour on Food FM.
Bordeaux scarcely needs an introduction. The world's largest fine wine producing region, well over 100,000 hectares, more than four times the size of Burgundy. It's also the most famous in the world and sometimes the most controversial, commanding some of the highest prices for its wines. Though these days, it has to be said, Burgundy gives it a run for its money. Who better to extol the virtues of this magnificent region than Stephen Brook, an acclaimed Bordeaux expert, the author of the newly released fourth edition of The Complete Bordeaux. Stephen, welcome to The Drinking Hour.
Thank you.
I say extol the virtues, but actually, to give you credit, you paint a very balanced picture of Bordeaux, I think. This is no hagiography, so we should reflect all of that. But let's begin by talking about the positives. What makes Bordeaux so magnificent, do you think?
It's a combination of factors. Climatically, it's just in the right spot. It's got some maritime influence, which gives the wines their freshness. It has different but magnificent soil types, which are perfectly adapted to the major grape varieties of Bordeaux. And something that perhaps isn't talked about so much, but since the 18th century, there's been a very strong commercial structure in place. It was the nobility that owned the vineyards, but there were a large number of Irish, Dutch, British merchants based in Bordeaux, and it was their task, as it is today, to distribute the wines, to sell the wines, so that the nobility didn't have to sully themselves with the dirty commercial matters. But that created a sort of worldwide network and demand for the wines of Bordeaux. So as I say, it's a mixture of different factors.
A very good summary. Bordeaux's impact is felt all over the world, of course, and not just the quality of its wines. Its legacy has been all sorts of factors in terms of grape varieties and blends, hasn't it?
Yes. I mean, it's been the model for countless other wine regions in the world. I mean, Napa Valley is an obvious example, or Coonawarra in Australia. These are regions that have tried to not copy, but to emulate the magic of Bordeaux by planting the same varieties and aiming for a similar climatic background, which would allow them to make wines that would have at least a passing resemblance to Bordeaux. But of course, Bordeaux is sui generis. Nothing tastes quite like Bordeaux except Bordeaux. But there are other regions in the world that have clearly been influenced by Bordeaux and which do make extremely good wines.
In your introduction, one of my favorite parts was where you try to identify just what it is that makes Bordeaux what it is, in terms of, as you say, it's been emulated all around the world, and yet there's something. I called it a je ne sais quoi there. Those are my words. But you do come up with a few thoughts as to what it is that makes it distinctive and special, don't you?
Well, other regions, such as Napa in California or Coonawarra in South Australia, can emulate Bordeaux in the sense they plant the same grape varieties, and they have a climate that, while not identical to Bordeaux, is not dissimilar in certain respects. So it's not a foolish ambition for those regions, and there are others, like the Tuscan coast, that try and produce wines that are, as I say, emulate Bordeaux without actually copying Bordeaux. But what Bordeaux's got, which these other wines or other regions can't really establish, this is a term I've pinched from our best wine writer, Hugh Johnson, cut. which is there's something on the palate that there's fruit, of course, but there's also some acidity, there's tannins, there's structure, there's a compound of different elements that keeps the wine lively on the palate and also gives the wine its capacity to age. Cut is a personal and rather not very accurate term in a way, but I understand exactly what is meant. And you won't find that so much in Napa Valley. In Napa Valley, you get all the ripeness of the Bordeaux varieties, a plushness, a generosity of oak usage and so on, but you're unlikely to get that brightness, that cut that you can find, I think, only in Bordeaux.
Yes, I mean, as you say, Hugh is a great man from whom to borrow, and he does have this ability to identify things like that and write about it so beautifully. You talked there about the soil types, two major types, gravel and clay limestone. Just expand a little on those soils and what makes them special.
Yes, well, on the left bank, and we're talking about Graves, Sauternes, and the Médoc, there were enormous deposits, glacial deposits of gravel tens of thousands of years ago. And they vary in depth from a couple of meters to 10 or more meters. And what that does is it provides impeccable drainage so that the wines never get vines never get waterlogged. They retain their vigor and their energy, and they have other secondary advantages on gravel soils. Gravel is really small stones rather than, you know, the gravel you'd associate with a gravel pit. So that it will warm up during the day and retain and irradiate warmth during the night. So even in Bordeaux's relatively cool climate, the grapes continue to ripen well after the sun goes down. Then on the other side of the river, you've got clay soils and limestone soils. These are perfectly adapted to Merlot, which is the principal grape variety on the right bank, just as Cabernet Sauvignon is on the left bank. It's just a magical combination of soil type and grape variety that just works. I mean, there are other soils in Bordeaux, but these are easily the most important ones. In parts of the Médoc, you've got fairly deep clay soils, which are cold, and it's hard to get the grapes to ripen. So, you know, if you want a great wine from the left bank, you really should be looking for gravel soils, and there's no shortage of them.
And grape varieties. As you mentioned there, we tend to associate left bank with Cabernet Sauvignon, right bank with Merlot. But you say in the book, it is more nuanced than that, isn't it?
It is. There have always been, at least for the last 120 years, five principal grape varieties in Bordeaux: Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, but also Cabernet Franc, Petit Verdot, and Malbec in small quantities. So you've got this palette of flavors and structures. What's changed, I think, quite a lot in recent years is that more Petit Verdot has been planted, especially in areas like Margaux. It gives color, gives density. You mustn't overdo it, but the growers refer to Petit Verdot as a kind of seasoning. It should never be the principal grape variety, but say 8%, 10% will give depth and grip to the palate, which is what they're looking for. However, on the other bank, where Merlot is a dominant variety, there's increasing interest in Cabernet Franc. And the reason is that with global warming, Merlot is getting super ripe these days. And that means wines with very high alcohols, sometimes residual sugar, which is not really what most people are looking for from Bordeaux. It may pass muster in Napa Valley, but it's not what you want from a great Bordeaux. So Cabernet Franc ripens usually a bit earlier, at lower sugars, better acidity. So it cuts the weight and the richness of the Merlot and gives a more complex wine. And there are leading estates on the right bank, such as Chablis Blanc and Auzonne, where around 50% of the surface is planted to Cabernet Franc. So it's becoming an increasingly important factor. And this is a big change over the last, let's say, 20 years.
I'll come to climate change in a moment, because it's really reset the dial, and it's fascinating and you know, worrying at the same time. But let's just stick with the grape varieties for a moment more, because you devote some of the introduction to those varieties, obviously, they being so important. You also have the percentage figures of plantings. And there's strikingly more Merlot than Cabernet Sauvignon, despite the fact that Cabernet tends to be the one that's revered the most, doesn't it?
Yes, but it needs to get ripe. And there are areas where it doesn't get so ripe. And remember, there's a large area in Bordeaux that is, unkind people would say they should rather have planted potatoes than vines, but they're fairly undistinguished soils, especially in regions like the Entre-deux-Mers or Bordeaux Supérieur. I'm not saying these are bad wines, but they're relatively simple wines. And Merlot is much easier to grow and to ripen. So it would be the grape of first choice for many growers. Whereas in the Grave or in the Médoc, if you have the right soils, we're talking about gravel soils, it would be a huge shame not to plant Cabernet Sauvignon, because it gives the most outstanding results.
There was a little bit of talk a couple of years ago about these new approved varieties for Bordeaux. Are we seeing much impact from the varieties that have been kind of imported from elsewhere to deal with climate change?
No, not yet. That could change over the next 10 years. There are three or four varieties that might be well adapted to Bordeaux, not getting overripe, not getting too high sugars, having interesting flavors. The Bordelais are very cautious, and only a very small percentage, I think 10% is the maximum that can be used in any blend. So it plays a relatively small part in the blends. I'm not even sure at what point these varieties will become authorized. I think we're on the brink of it now. I don't have the exact dates in my head. But I think Bordeaux needs to retain its character, its individuality. And if you introduce sort of alien flavors, however interesting, you're going to lose some of that typicity. So I think the Bordeaux growers and authorities are being quite right in being very cautious about the introduction of new varieties, but at the same time, keeping an open mind about the fact that they've got to do something about global warming and overripeness. And one of the measures that could deal with this and give greater balance to the wines could be the absorption of small quantities of these new, or at least new to Bordeaux, varieties.
And I suppose they're helped by the fact that they have a culture of blending.
Yes. Always has been like that. There are some pure Merlot wines, not a great many, but even in Sauternes, most wines are a blend of two varieties, Sauvignon Blanc for acidity and freshness, and Semillon for fat and richness and botrytis. So as you say, it's an old Bordeaux tradition that's been going on for hundreds of years. Of course, before phylloxera, there were varieties that we haven't heard of anymore because they're extinct or weren't replanted because they gave very low yields for a variety of reasons. So there was a greater palette of varieties probably 150, 200 years ago than there is today. As I say, these days, we're really talking about a maximum of five grape varieties for the red wines.
So climate change, then. I was talking to Margaret Rand, who you will know well, of course, the other day for an edition of The Drinking Hour, and she was talking about editing the Pocket wine book, which, of course, she does for Hugh Johnson. And she talked about how in her 40 years, everything had changed as a result of climate change. Riper wines being more easily produced and the focus changing. And that is really true of Bordeaux, isn't it?
Absolutely. It started really in the late 2000s. And I remember in 2010, there were some wines, we're talking really about ripe bank wines, where there's Merlot, which gets super ripe. There were wines with 15.5 degrees of alcohol. Personally, I find pretty much undrinkable. I don't want to be whacked on the head with alcohol and flavor. I don't mind, fairly high level of alcohol, but 15.5 is just getting a little ridiculous. We're talking about Châteauneuf-du-Pape, and we don't want Châteauneuf-du-Pape when we're opening a bottle of Bordeaux. And I was doing what I suppose we now call a podcast about nearly 10 years ago with an American writer, and I mentioned a chateau, and I won't mention it again, that had erred by producing these highly alcoholic wines. And I later got a 2,000-word email from the proprietor, who I knew slightly, telling me that, of course, as a wine writer, I knew much more about winemaking than he did. And so a very sort of sarcastic email. But the upshot was that I was in Bordeaux a few weeks later and went to see him. And we spent a very cordial couple of hours talking about all these issues. And now the same property has been sold, and there's a new team in there, and they are actively exploring ways to get the grapes to ripen earlier so as to avoid very high sugars and consequently very high alcohols. So even Bordeaux proprietors on the right bank are aware that this is a problem. Yes, there's a market for these wines, just as there is in, say, Barossa Valley for wines with 16 alcohol. But I think people with long experience of Bordeaux know that these are sort of aberrations, and that should not be the way forward for Bordeaux. But it's a very tricky issue because there are various, say, facile ways of dealing with overripeness. For example, you could crop to a much higher level, so by which I mean you have higher yields. So you're producing more wine, and because you've got more bunches on the vine, you're going to get a lower level of ripeness. But the downside of that is you also may get greenness. You may get herbaceous aromas and flavors, which nobody really wants. So there are no sort of easy solutions. One thing that I think a lot of growers are doing is they're abandoning this emphasis, which is very common, even today in California, in Napa Valley, of going for phenolic ripeness. That is to say, it's not just enough for the grapes to be ripe, but the pips have to be ripe, the seeds have to be ripe, and that only happens when you get very high sugars. And that's when you get these monstrous wines with very high alcohols. And there are people in California, and certainly in Bordeaux, who are saying, you know, this phenolic ripeness stuff, it's a nonsense. You're just ending up with unbalanced wines. And what you need to do is find ways, primarily in the vineyard rather than in the winery, to produce wines with better balance and less weight and sweetness. And one thing they do in California is they water back, I think they call it. Basically, they add water to the wine, which will bring down the alcohol and also bring down some of the flavors. So it's not a route that I think anybody in Bordeaux would want to pursue. And anyway, I think it's probably illegal. So it's a real issue, especially on the right bank. But the Bordelais are well aware of it and are gradually getting to grips with it. It's taken them a while, but they're now starting.
Mm, and sustainability is a big deal in Bordeaux. I mean, you mention in the book that it's scarcely worth mentioning the HVE standard, yes, of some of these estates, because pretty much everyone does it.
Exactly. I mean, sustainability is really pretty meaningless. But the HVE system, which applies to agriculture as a whole, not simply to grape farming, lays down certain criteria, certain methods that are environmentally sound, of that provide a healthy working environment for vineyard workers. After all, if you're spraying a lot of toxic products in your vineyards, it's going to affect some of the vigneron, the vineyard workers as well. So it's quite a complex issue. But certainly it's positive that the Bordeaux, at long last, are thinking about sustainability and laying down criteria for a healthy grape production. Because it wasn't like that in the past. Bordeaux was very slow to take on organic farming and biodynamic farming. The excuse always was, well, we have a maritime climate, we have a lot of rot, we need to treat our vines. And to a large extent, that is true. But I think these days, a lot of top estates have demonstrated that you don't need to use loads of chemicals and fertilizers in order to get your grapes to ripen. You can do this naturally in the vineyard. That is the part to pursue, rather than manipulating the production in a way that is going to give unbalanced and in some cases not very healthy grapes.
Mm. Bordeaux has a very good track record on sustainability, but it also has its challenges. As I mentioned at the start, this book is no hagiography. You're a lover of Bordeaux, yet there are points in the introduction where it could almost be an abusive relationship. You're very candid about some of the complexities of the Bordeaux way of doing things.
Yes, it's not just a question of winemaking or farming. I mean, it's often been said, so I'm not the first person to point this out, that when a wine merchant goes to Burgundy to make a deal, to buy some wines or get an allocation, they'll go down to the cellar with a couple of glasses and a pipette and try the wines and talk. In Bordeaux, you'll go into the chateau's office with a calculator and a secretary and work out what would be an acceptable deal. So it's a different approach. Bordeaux is much more commercial. As I mentioned right at the beginning, it does have this commercial structure that's been there for centuries, and it's not really a region in the prestigious areas of family estates. They exist in some of the less well-known regions of Bordeaux, but say in Burgundy, and I know, alas, this is beginning to change, majority of estates are family-owned, and you're dealing with the family. Often in Bordeaux, you're dealing with corporations or managers, or I'm not saying that produces poor wines, not a bit of it, but it's a different structure, it's a different approach.
And it can be frustrating sometimes to fans of Bordeaux wines.
Yes, because the prices aren't that stable. They do tend to go up and down, and often growers will wait for the results of the Primeur campaign, especially the scores given by the leading critics. And if they get a very high score, they'll push the price up a bit more than they originally intended. So you know, there's always pressure on getting the maximum return. I can't blame them for that, but it makes it a very sort of commercial environment. And it also means there's less stability of pricing in Bordeaux than there would be, say, in other French regions. If you go to Burgundy, yes, of course, prices will go up in a great vintage, but they will also come down a bit in a poor vintage. Whereas in Bordeaux, they'll tend to say, oh, gosh, we had a terrible year last year. We better, you know, put our prices up because we need to recoup some of our investments. If they have a great year, they say, we've got a great year here. We better put our prices up because it's a great year and people will reward us. So, you know, it's complicated.
Yeah, it's kind of having your cake and eating it, I suppose. The Empremeur market remains very important, I think, to Bordeaux. For those listening who aren't familiar, this is wines that are released for sale before they're completed. The critics taste samples of these wines very early in their life. It's something that I am terrible at as a taster. It's very, very difficult to taste those wines, I think, and make an assessment. But the system remains important. You actually say in the book that you're not especially keen on Empremeur tasting either, are you?
Not at all. I do it. I go there and I taste the wines Empremeur, and I usually do it blind, so I don't even know what the wines are, because I'm interested. But I don't score the wines and I don't write about them. Basically, I don't write about wines, and this is true of 99% of the book, The Complete Bordeaux. Everything I write about is in bottle. In other words, it's a final product. And I've been very critical of the Empremeur system. And I likened it in an earlier book to, you go into a garage, a showroom, and you say, oh, you'd like to buy our Ferrari. That's fantastic. Well, here it is. But you'll see it doesn't actually have a steering wheel yet, and it doesn't have a motor yet. But, you know, we know this is going to be a fabulous car in a couple of years. So give us all your money. And it is a bit like that with Empremeur. You're asked to come up with money up front, which is great news for the proprietors and to a lesser extent to the merchants. But yeah, you can make a serious mistake. There's very little control over what is being sampled in the Empremeur tastings, which I think is a major criticism. And the Bordelais, for the most part, have resisted any kind of system which verifies the accuracy of samples. If I'm tasting a wine Empremeur, I often have no idea what I'm tasting. I know what the grapes in the vineyard are, but I don't know how the blend has been put together. And I do know that a cellar master and proprietor, if they find a barrel that's showing particularly well, they're more likely to bottle that for the en-primeur tastings than do a representative sample of the entire production. I'm not saying everybody does that, but the temptation is amazing because, you know, the higher score you get, the higher the price that you can probably charge for your wine. And people have made enormous investments in these prestigious properties, often buying them for hundreds of millions of euros. They need to get a return on that investment. The en-primeur system is very much open to abuse, which is why I'm a major critic of it. But I know that the majority of my colleagues make a serious attempt to assess those wines in an accurate and dispassionate way. But I also know that the system is against them because you really don't know what you're tasting. So I do have a rant about this in the book and in previous books. So I won't go on about it any longer.
It's a good rant, though. You mentioned, talking of systems, that the 1855 classification has taken on a life of its own. It's all slightly absurd, isn't it?
Well, you have to remember that whereas, say, again, to come back to Burgundy, you have a hierarchy of vineyards, Grand Cru, Premier Cru, Village, and they are based on an assessment of the quality of those vineyards. It's not like that in Bordeaux. The reason why in 1855 Lafitte, Mouton, and others were classified as first growths or top second growths is because the market was there for those wines. People were prepared to pay very high prices for them, which is indeed an indication of quality. But nobody was going into the vineyards and saying, this is a really good patch of soil. People are saying, you know, if I buy this wine, chances are it will increase in value. And even if it doesn't, the quality is such that it's going to be drinkable with pleasure for many years. So the 1855 classification is the recognition of a commercial reality. It's not a recognition of the quality of the soil or the grape varieties. Just to give you one example, Chateau Mouton, which is the first growth, they, like other first growths, have bought other chateaus and incorporated them into Mouton. So something that was a fifth growth or even less suddenly becomes a first growth. Now, I know the people who make the wines at the first growths, and I know that if they don't think the wine is of outstanding quality, it doesn't go into the grand vin, it'll be used for the second or third wine or even sold off. So I'm not saying they are cynical about this, but nevertheless, it's a system where first growth can expand simply by buying neighboring parcels, often at an inflated price, but nevertheless, they can do that. And those vineyards automatically become first growths, which is a bit strange.
It is rather, yes. Your guide is so comprehensive, obviously breaking down the region into its sub-regions, into its component parts, and then into individual estates. This is now in its fourth edition. It must be an absolutely enormous undertaking to keep all of this up to date.
It is, but one is greatly helped by the internet. I mean, there are countless newsletters about Bordeaux and about changes. There are websites of the leading chateaus. There are newsletters from merchants. There are loads of ways to get information about what's going on in Bordeaux. But Bordeaux is in a constant state of flux. I mean, this book only came out about 6 weeks ago. And since then, a second growth, Chateau Lascombe, over 100 hectares in Margaux, has been sold. So things are always changing. And yes, I have to stay on top of that. And sometimes it's not that easy, that's part of what I do.
You also conclude in your introduction, which is a weighty introduction. I keep referencing the introduction, but it's more than an introduction, really. It's kind of a book in itself. And it's great for that, by the way, just lest you think I'm saying it's overlong.
Thank you.
You say that the wines of Bordeaux have never been better.
I think it's true. I mean, I think it's not only true of Bordeaux. I think it would be true in Burgundy, be true in the Languedoc. There's more technical expertise. There's an army of specialist consultants who look at the vineyards, who look at the grape varieties, who advise growers, you know, don't plant this grape variety here. If you've got it, you should really replace it with something else. When you're fermenting the wine, don't ferment at too high a temperature. Have a slower fermentation to extract more flavor in a at a lower temperature. So there are all kinds of refinements in the viticulture and also in the winemaking that have allowed quality to improve steadily. There were vintages like 1972, which basically was like drinking asparagus juice. They were horrible wines. They were unripe. That couldn't happen now. The growers can intervene in ways to make sure that that kind of ghastly vintage doesn't occur again. It's not going to make a poor vintage into a great vintage, but they can prevent some of the horrors of the past. A poor vintage in Bordeaux is pretty rare. I think the last one I can think of was probably 2013, which wasn't terrible, but it was certainly patchy. The other factor, of course, is competition. I mean, you just can't afford to make a mediocre wine. And here the en primeur tastings play a positive role, because if you get a bunch of low scores from some of the leading critics, it's not going to do your reputation much good. So there's an incentive to do the best that you can. Obviously, you've got to work with the vineyards that you've got, with the teams that you've got, with the terroir that you've got. But nevertheless, there is this incentive to produce the best possible wine from the materials at your disposal. And that wasn't the case a long time ago. There were people who had a secure market, say, in Belgium. So they just churned out all this stuff and sent it off to Belgium, where merchants and their customers wouldn't complain too much if the price was right. They really can't get away with that any longer. And I think that's why quality of the wine is so much higher. I think at the moment Bordeaux is sensational in quality. But as I say, it's not the only region in France, or indeed in Europe or Australia, where that's the case. Everybody has upped their game because they really have no choice.
And thank goodness for that. There's a very useful vintage guide at the back of the book. And my birth year, sadly, is 1972, which is uniformly dreadful.
Bad luck.
Indeed. It does sound like an absolute stinker, 1972, from what you were saying. But the other end of the spectrum, what's your favourite vintage? Because you've tasted all of them, or pretty much all of them, for sure.
As a general rule, I prefer vintages that are lean and precise and elegant to vintages that are big and fleshy and super ripe. So what that means in practice is that I like years such as 1996, 2010. Okay, you did have some high alcohols, but you also had high tannins and high acidities. It was a very complex year. And then vintages such as 2016, which are similar in that respect, in that they had high alcohol, but also high acidity, a great deal of intensity. To use Hugh's term again, vintages with cut. Those are the wines that are my personal preferences. But, you know, there are absolutely gorgeous wines on the right bank, you know, 2015 or 2000, which are voluptuous and hedonistic. And I would appreciate them almost as much. But I do like that extra bit of elegance in the wine, because it's the character of the wine that makes you want to have a second glass. If you just have a mouthful of big fruit, which can happen, say, with a Napa Cabernet, you get sated fairly quickly. At least I do. I can't knock those wines back. But you have a really well-balanced Bordeaux. You can drink it in reasonable quantities without falling over.
And beyond the first, second, third, fourth, fifth growths and their often eye-watering prices, there is still a great deal of value to be had in Bordeaux, because they produce an awful lot of wine, don't they?
Yes, yes. I mean, this is one of the, I hope, the valuable features of my book, is that it's not just about classified growths or well-established properties like, you know, Chemin Blanc or Ozone or in Saint-Emilion. I'm equally interested in regions such as Castillon, which is next door to Saint-Emilion, Blaye, Bourg, the Graves, where the prices are a fraction of those in the classified growths, but the soils are good, and if the owners are conscientious, yields are kept reasonable, the wines are oaked but not over-oaked, and so on and so forth. If they're well-farmed and well-made, those regions have the ability to produce absolutely delicious wines. And I taste a lot of Napa wines. I do like Napa wines, but I look at some of them and I look at the price and I think, you know, I could buy four bottles of Castillon for the price of this wine, and it would give me a lot more pleasure. And I think it's very important that Bordeaux tries to shed this image of being, you know, just pure luxury and prestige and showing off. This whole concept of label drinking, I mean, it's still very important, I gather, in Asia. I don't have that much experience. But for the consumer, it's worth remembering that there are huge swathes of Bordeaux that make excellent wines, mostly red, but also white, that are delicious and affordable. Okay, they may not age for 20 years. That doesn't matter. Most people don't have cellars these days. They drink their wines within 3, 5, 8 years, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And these other regions, the Côte de Bordeaux, the Graves, are perfectly adapted to that kind of consumption, and they offer absolutely terrific value. I'm not saying everything is good from them. There are some poor wines there, but not that many, and it's the job of myself and my various colleagues to identify the wines that offer value and quality.
Yeah, and the guide, the book, is really helpful on that front, actually, because it is it's so comprehensive and goes way beyond the big names, the famous estates, as you say, which is really great, very, very useful. Just the final...
I don't owe anybody anything. I'm totally independent. It's true, if I have to declare an interest, that I do stay in certain chateaus because I just can't afford to sit in hotels for weeks and weeks in Bordeaux. And some of the proprietors have become friends. Some of them barely give me the time of day. So I try not to be influenced by these things. Maybe it's a little naive of me, but I think I really am independent, and I have properties that are owned by people I consider friends. And if I don't like the wine, I won't hesitate to say so. And I don't think they hold it against me. I think one has to be honest and not beholden to, well, any school of winemaking or any group of winemakers. Or you've got to do your best to stay independent. It's not easy, but I think I do it, and I can think of other people who do it as well. It's very important.
It is very important, and it is evident in the Complete Bordeaux as well. So you should be very satisfied with what you've delivered, I think. And I don't just say that to be a creep. I really did enjoy what I've read of the book so far. And its comprehensive nature.
Thank you.
I can't let you go without asking you the question that we kind of ask our distinguished guests when they come on the podcast, and that is a desert island wine. And we're going to make yours, I think, more specific. What would be your desert island Bordeaux wine? If you could only have one and you were stuck on an island, but it had to be from Bordeaux, which I think is important in this context, what would it be?
It's a nightmare question, but I'll try and answer it. I would say Chateau Lafleur, which is a small property in Pomerol, and it's owned by the Guinaudot family, who I've known for some time, and they are the least flash people imaginable, even though their wines do fetch very high prices. And they're fanatical in the vineyard. They divide their already small vineyard into numerous plots, and farm them separately, monitor the grapes very closely, and create these magical blends. And even though they only make, I don't know what the figure is, 10,000-15,000 bottles, they also make a second wine. So it's not as if they bottle everything at a high price. Their second wine is not cheap either. But nevertheless, it shows that they're only prepared to put into bottle with their Chateau Lafleur label the wines that they think are truly outstanding. They age beautifully, and being in Pomerol with a lot of Merlot, but also a lot of Cabernet Franc, they have this sensual quality that is irresistible, and they age extremely well. I think I am slightly influenced by my affection for the family, because they are a contradiction of what I was saying earlier, which is that Bordeaux is all about business. These people, yes, of course they want to make a good living, but it's also about quality and relationships and family, and visiting there, you're likely to meet three generations of the family. And it's what a wine estate should be. And as the quality is absolutely impeccable, if I had to choose one estate, I would pick Chateau Lafleur. So there's your answer.
Great. A dream answer to a nightmare question. Stephen, thank you very much. Congratulations on the book. And thank you so much for taking the time out to join us on The Drinking Hour.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me, David.
Stephen Brook, author of The Complete Bordeaux, the fourth edition, now on sale. And if that's whetted your appetite for more about Bordeaux, then you're in the right place. In 86 episodes of The Drinking Hour, bizarrely, we've only actually featured the region once in a chat about the Hot 50 wines back in episode 20. But we're going to make up for it with two special editions brought to you with Wines of Bordeaux starting next week. We'll hear from its dynamic new generation of winemakers. And I shall have a go at blending, asking a top winemaker to critique my efforts. And I've never made a wine in my life.
The Drinking Hour on Food FM.
You're listening to The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in association with the International Wine and Spirit Competition, using the best in the world to judge the best in the world.
Well, we round off as ever with some medal winners from the IWSC Hall of Fame. Next time, we'll have a selection of Bordeaux medal winners for our special edition, the first of two. But this time, we're featuring some incredible wines from elsewhere in the world that reflect where those Bordeaux grapes have travelled. And Stephen and I were talking about the incredible global presence of those Bordeaux grapes. So a great place to start, a gold medal winner for Washington State in the USA, one of the biggest wineries there, Chateau Saint-Michel, Cabernet Sauvignon 2018, a gold medal winner, as I say, with 95 points. Here's what the judging panel had to say. Elegant and pronounced aromas of fine red and dark fruit leap from the glass. A wonderful concentration of fruit with eucalyptus, cacao and chocolate adding complexity. Characterful and vibrant with fine tannins, cedar oak notes and a spicy finish. It's to New Zealand next. I was actually on the judging panel for this wonderful wine. Church Road McDonald Series Cabernet Sauvignon 2018 from Hawke's Bay. This was a gold medal winner, 95 points. I remember it well. My fellow judges, Isabel, Master Sommelier, and another sommelier, Andrea Altavilla, also super impressed, as was Dersiu Viana Jr., MW, who was in charge that day, who had to ratify the result. Here's our tasting note. Elegant, savoury and smoky aromas, which continue onto the palate and complement the rich, dark fruit palate. The wine has good typicity with well-integrated oak spices and fine tannins, a generous example with a sleek, powerful structure. Next, a Bordeaux blend from Japan, Hombo Shuzu Chateau Mars Hosaka Hineshiro Cabernet Merlot Late Harvest 2018 from Yamanashi Province, a gold medal winner, 95 points. Here's the tasting note from the judges, a polished nose with succulent dark fruit, enhanced by chocolate and mocha oak. This wine shows great harmony on the palate, expanding into complex notes of green tea, limestone, minerals, and rose. This is a standout example with superb personality. And next to another incredible wine, not just a gold medal winner this time, but also a trophy winner, so reflecting best in show, this from Mexico, Monte Zanich Edición Limitada Cabernet Franc 2020. Two masters of wine and a master sommelier on the panel here. And I also got to taste this blind at the trophy judging sessions. Here's the tasting note. Alluring varietal benchmark on the nose and palate. Everything you hope for. Black cherry, cassis, green pepper, pencil shavings and earthiness, ripe with well-balanced acidity, smooth tannins and refreshing long finish. A classed act, we said. And whilst we're on the subject of trophy winners, here's a great place to round off. Inniskillen Niagara Ice Wine Cabernet Sauvignon 2019. This from the Niagara Peninsula in Ontario, Canada. A gold medal winner. It took home a trophy as well. Ice wine as I'm sure you know, is where the grapes literally freeze on the vines, increasing their intensity. And here's the very warm tasting note. Wonderful green bronze hue that could be mistaken for masala. Concentrated nose of toffee, coffee, and baked apples. Great acidity draws out the palate of bruised apples, hazelnuts, and warm fig jam. Ultra penetrating concentration and focus in this, an absolute stunner, they said. What a way to round off. That's it for this time. My thanks to Stephen Brook. You can follow us at Food FM Radio on Instagram and Twitter. I'm Mr. Venusaurus on Instagram and Twitter. Do join us next time for the first of our Bordeaux special editions. But until then, it's goodbye.
The Drinking Hour on Food FM.
You're listening to The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in association with the International Wine and Spirit Competition, using the best in the world to judge the best in the world.